Herbert London is president of the Hudson Institute and has real concerns about any health care plan that tries to bypass the element of personal choice. Let's talk about that, Mr. London, about serious health care decisions as they're usually made now versus what you think we might expect under Obamacare.
Well, there are some things, notwithstanding the president's rather passionate speech the other night, that have to be considered. The first and perhaps overriding consideration is if you have all of these additional people that are now going to be covered through one form of insurance or another, where is health care going to come from? You can't possibly expand medical activities in the United States dramatically, so you're going to be put willy-nilly into a position of rationing. And the great concern that I have is if you're talking about rationing, who's going to be making that decision? Who decides whether, in fact, you're going to get that ulcer operation or you're going to have your cancer treatment occur? And that is undoubtedly going to be a government bureaucrat. Now, we have already seen what governments are capable of doing or not capable of doing. And when a government bureaucrat is now going to be involved in making these decisions, it certainly gives pause about the kind of quality of health care that you're going to receive or whether, in fact, you're going to receive health care at all. And we know from the Canadian example as well as the British example, there are a lot of people waiting on the queue who die in the process because they don't get the health care that they deserve. So this is the unsaid portion of the health care provisions that the president has been talking about, and it's the matter, of course, of greatest concern to me.
It sounds like dealing with a really bad HMO, and I did that myself at one time, and found out, by the way, and I was told by the doctor in the plan, and I had to quit the doctor. I liked the doctor. She was an excellent doctor. But I told her, I can't put up with this anymore. And she said, I know, it's driving me crazy because the person who had made the decision, and it was a fairly minor treatment involved, that they wouldn't do it. She said she checked and found out that the previous month, this case officer who made the decision had been a cashier at the Woolworth store, the old Woolworth store, just off Market Street in San Francisco. Now, if a private HMO will hire people like that and let them make decisions, I can only imagine, giving the track record of government bureaucracies, what kind of people they would put in that position of responsibility.
Well, you raise, I think, a very important and interesting point. I mean, look, any time you look at a government service, walk into your local post office, for example, and you would find a level of lassitude that you probably can't find in almost any private organization in the world. I use the Acela train quite frequently. Getting online and waiting to get someone attend to your ticket is one of the most difficult and frustrating experiences that one can imagine. And now imagine if you're going to try and check out your ticket for health care, and you're going to have the same kind of people who are making these decisions. I think it's going to be a source of enormous frustration, and in the end, well, lives are at stake. When we talk about health care, we're generally talking about whether, in fact, you have the right to determine whether, in fact, you're going to receive a certain treatment or have a certain doctor or be involved in a certain kind of decision. Now those decisions, to some degree, are going to involve a third party, and namely, a nameless bureaucrat sitting in a Washington, D.C. office who's going to be involved in this decision with you. And as I said, that gives me pause. Anytime you're talking about rationing, you have to ask the obvious question, who is going to be making these decisions? And if it's someone in government, boy, I think you've got a problem.
I am casually acquainted with and much admire Dr. Thomas Sowell, who is an occasional guest on this program, and he poses what seems to me a very pertinent question, and anybody who thinks this Obamacare is such a wonderful idea might want to think about this. If it's such a great idea, why does the plan call for it to be instituted in 2013? If it's so wonderful, why wouldn't they want to do it immediately? I think the answer is pretty obvious. What about you?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, Tom Sowell is a remarkable fellow and someone I admire greatly, and he does raise a very interesting question. And there are a lot of questions of that kind that have emerged from the speech as well. I mean, the president has said, for example, that this bill is not going to increase the deficit by one dime. Now, even the House bills, the two House bills that are three House bills, excuse me, that are presently being considered, go from $500 billion to $900 billion of additional expense. So What do you mean it's not going to add to the deficit by one dime? How can you find savings in this if the president says, and I think quite appropriately, that we need more in the way of preventive care? That's expensive. I'm not opposed to preventive care, but it's an expensive proposition. Is everyone in the United States going to get a colonoscopy? That's an expensive business. So when he says it's not going to cost any more, that is complete dissimulation. There is no question it's going to cost a lot more. And then you add to the extraordinary expenses that we've already seen in this administration. We are going to be facing the unfunded liabilities in the United States as far as the eye can see and as far as my grandchildren and great-grandchildren will live. And so that's one of the great problems that I think the American people understand intuitively. It is not only the constraint on freedom that we're going that will exist with the kind of medical care we receive, but also the enormous burden that is going to be placed on our children and grandchildren as a result of the deficits that will emerge through this health care program.
There's supposed to be some way of balancing an older person's age against the cost of a particular treatment or medical procedure. How do you see that working?
Well, again, this involves a third party. And while I think it may be something of an exaggeration to talk about death councils, and of course the president made reference to that during the course of his presentation, look at it this way. If you're an 85-year-old person and you have cancer, will some bureaucrat decide that aggressive treatment is desirable for you? Now, there may very well be a family decision. Maybe mom and dad and the children get together and they discuss this problem and say, you know, something, maybe we don't want that aggressive treatment. But do you want the government bureaucrats saying under no circumstances can aggressive treatment be given to this person? Because when you consider the actuarial tables, he's not going to have a long period to live. And after all, we don't want to engage in a $100,000 proposition in part because there aren't enough years left in her life anyway. Why not simply go through the natural course of events and let nature take its course? Again, I'm not opposed to that kind of decision, but I am opposed to the idea of a government bureaucrat making it for the family. That's what concerns me.
Yeah, and you could visualize a situation where you're old, you have a curable condition. You can be cured, but it would cost money. And the government response you'd probably get would be, here, take your pill, stay zonked out until you die, because it would cost too much to fix you. That's pretty much what we could expect, isn't it?
Well, this is the point that I was getting at. I mean, that is the great fear that I have. Now, of course, you have insurance companies that may make that decision now. But the thing is that the insurance company makes that decision after the family has arrived at a conclusion. Now we may have a requirement that the government serve as a third party in those discussions. That's a little different. And as I say, it worries me a great deal when you consider that the government concern is always going to be efficiencies. It's not going to be what is the best possible health care, but what is the appropriate health care. And there's a difference between the best possible health care and appropriate health care. That decision should be made by the patient. It shouldn't be made by a third party.
You have pointed out that the most used word by the Obamacare advocates is appropriate. What kind of care is appropriate? You talk about leaving a lot of room for interpretation. That really does, doesn't it?
Well, this is one of the great problems in this business. I mean, when, you know, there had been a lot of discussion about the nature of the Hippocratic Oath. When people graduate from medical school, they all raise their hand and take the Hippocratic Oath. And what you say, I will provide the best possible care I can for the patients that I'm going to service or treat. And I think that that has never been very much a part of history for thousands of years. Now we're saying something slightly different. We want doctors to provide appropriate care, which generally means care commensurate with, one, the kind and price of treatment for a given patient. And what we're saying is that we're really looking at actuarial tables, we're looking at a variety of conditions, we're looking at whether, in fact, this is commensurate with what the country can afford. There are all kinds of considerations, or I say qualifications, that are now put into this calculus. So this is an entirely new way of looking at medical care. And again, one wonders whether this is going to be quality care of the kind the president has talked about, or marginal care that may very well result from having a bureaucrat make these decisions.
The two biggest killers in this country every year, I believe, are heart disease and cancer. Presumably that's true in most other countries as well. Talk about the recovery rate here versus the recovery rate in some of those utopian places that already have their government-run health care.
Well, Canada Canada and the UK have cancer patients that die at a rate 30% higher than the United States. And to some degree, it is very much related to the one-payer system that these two countries have. Because what happens is people very often are obliged to wait on a queue. One of the ways to deal with cancer, as you undoubtedly know, and of course your listening audience knows as well, is to try and treat it as early as possible. But if you're waiting on a queue and can't get in to see a doctor, and in fact cannot get the kind of treatment that is necessary, or can't even get the diagnosis that's necessary, obviously you're not going to treat that metastasis as appropriately as you can. So the importance of cancer treatment is to try and get there as early as possible. And to some degree, that's even true with heart problems, with heart disease. While there is an incremental deterioration in the arteries and with heart disease, one of the things that can often happen is you can arrest some of those problems if they're treated early. But again, if you're waiting on a long queue, the likelihood of getting to see a doctor is not as great as a system like ours, where in fact you can see a private physician if you choose to do so. So again, I think that one of the things that we have to understand is that it's not as if we don't have empirical evidence about the failures of the one-payer system. It doesn't work. When you have a government involved, you can be sure that you're going to have some deterioration in the quality of health care. That has been the experience that has occurred all around the globe. We should be able to learn from that experience. It's one of the reasons why I'm so skeptical about the government intervention into the health care plans that are emerging from both the House and the Senate.
There are, of course, endless liberal complaints about how expensive health care is in this country. But we are the richest country in the world, so wouldn't you normally expect there would be a correlation anyway?
Well, look, you raise a very important point. A rich country is going to spend more on health care. I mean, I think that's fairly obvious. When you think about it, people who have resources are going to say, look, I want to live as long as possible, but more importantly, I want to reduce morbidity. That is, I want to reduce all of those diseases and problems that emerge with aging. And that is a natural consequence of living in an affluent society. So it's not at all surprising that we spend a lot on health care. That's a natural consequence of being an affluent society. So I don't, and that argument, as far as I'm concerned, just doesn't fly. I think the more interesting argument is all of the waste that occurs in health care. And there, when you consider the fact that there's all of this defensive medicine because Joe Lawyer is going to determine whether, in fact, there's going to be litigation, that, I think, is an enormous way of, a very important way of dealing with this whole question. And the administration has been, up until this point, quite reluctant to deal with tort reform, although the president certainly did mention it during the course of his presentation, but mentioned it only as an experiment. When you consider the role that the plaintiff's bar plays in the Democratic Party, it's very unlikely you're going to get the tort reform that's necessary. But if you're looking for savings and the elimination of waste, that's a pretty good place to begin.
By the way, let me offer this observation. Nobody opposed to Obamacare should use terms like tort reform. I challenge you or anybody else to go out on any street in America and ask the first 100 people you meet, what does tort reform mean? And I guarantee you that at least 95 of them will have no bleeping idea what you're talking about.
Well, you're right. I mean, look, I'm terribly sorry. I didn't mean to sound academic. What I'm talking about is the use of lawyers and litigation in order to provide for a great deal of waste in the system. You can't find an obstetrician in the state of West Virginia. Why? Because there have been so many lawsuits against obstetricians that you can't have a baby in the state of West Virginia. That's a graphic example or an egregious example of like what the legal system can do to inhibit the kind of medical care that people need.
I have personally pointed out many times that if you go into any hospital in this country, any public hospital, you will see a sign saying that nobody will be denied treatment for lack of ability to pay. I've done considerable hospital time myself over a ravaged lifetime. I have yet to hear, maybe I've missed something, but I have yet to hear one Republican official, member of Congress or otherwise, make that statement and make it clear that nobody is being denied medical care in this country because they don't have the money to pay. I don't think the Republicans are being very effective in rebutting the Obamacare advocates. Do you?
Well, I think that the Republican Party has been asleep at the wheel on this one. I think you're absolutely correct. Moreover, who is the president who was responsible for introducing the legislation that would not deny anyone care in a public hospital? It was George Bush, Sr. George Bush Sr. was responsible for that legislation, and that was a Republican. And, of course, the Republicans don't even make this argument. But it's a very important argument because, as you quite rightly point out, there is no American who goes to a public institution, a public hospital, who can be denied medical care. And that is a point that should have an exclamation point on it. But, unfortunately, the Republicans, as I said, are virtually asleep at the wheel.
I was hit with a fairly, well, very serious disease and spent the entire month of February in a hospital, a big hospital. And I was told by the staff there that I was the only full-pay patient on the entire floor. So obviously a lot of people were who couldn't afford it were nevertheless getting medical care.
Well, that would not be unusual in almost any public hospital you would go to in the United States. And, you know, even when people say, well, there are all of these illegals living in the United States and they're denied health care, even illegals can go into a hospital and they may not have a dime in their pockets, would not be denied health care in the United States. So I think that point has to be made and unfortunately has not been made particularly effectively by the Republicans and certainly will not be made by the Democrats.
We're talking with Herbert London, president of the Hudson Institute, which is, tell people where to find you on the web.
Well, it's just Hudson.org is the way to reach us. And if any are interested in the work that I do, it's HerbLondon.org. I'd be very happy to respond to any of the concerns of your listeners. I have a new book out that you might make mention of called America's Secular Challenge as well.
Excellent. And we'll continue after a brief break on Hot Talk 560 KSFO. 725 OV, what's the story on the commute?
What we have here, brought to you by Black Oak Casino, is a stall in Napa County, 29 southbound at Livermore Road. It's a stall, as we mentioned. It's blocking the roadway in that location. Hayward, 880 southbound between A Street and 92 Jackson. It is slow going, traffic just sluggish through this stretch for just to be sluggish, I guess. And Vallejo, 37 westbound between Wallet and the bridge there. We've got two lanes merging to one, and it's slowing everybody down. No problems on the Bay Bridge here this morning, except there's slowing at the S-curve, the new section that they've got in there now. And as I mentioned, this is brought to you by Black Oak Casino.
You're listening to Lee Rogers on Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
With Herbert London, president of the Hudson Institute, we're talking about Obamacare. The dear leader talks about health care as being in a crisis, never mind the prescribed cure that he advocates wouldn't take effect for 4 years. Strange idea of a crisis. But I have yet, for example, to hear him describe Iran getting nuclear weapons. We're talking about a country that has vowed repeatedly to destroy us. I've yet to hear Obama describe that as a crisis. But health care is a crisis. Am I missing something?
Something happened there with the phone line, evidently. But, you know, that's a great
apparently
question, though.
So. We got to dig up Alexander Graham Bell and tell him
hello
to start all over. Yes, sir. I don't know what happened to the phone connection.
I'm terribly sorry. I just got cut off for a second.
That's a great question, though.
I'm just saying we're going to have to dig up Alexander Graham Bell and tell him, start over on this thing. It ain't working right. I was talking about how Obama calls the health care situation a crisis, yet the plan he advocates wouldn't take effect for 4 years, which is a strange idea of a crisis. But he doesn't seem to regard as a crisis the fact that Iran is on the verge of getting nuclear weapons, and we're talking about a country that's vowed repeatedly to destroy us. But you pointed out, I was reading the piece you did, about how Obama is big on deadlines, for his health plan, assuming that some reforms do need to be made. What is the difference, really, whether it's done this month or in November or like next April?
I do think you know the answer, and the answer is that the reason why you use the word crisis is because that's a way of pushing through legislation. If it's a crisis, obviously, then the Congress is obliged to act. As Rahm Emanuel has pointed out, you don't want to waste all of the good things that can emerge from a crisis. And most of it, of course, is putting pressure on the legislature. Now, it is interesting and rather ironic that we have Iran about to acquire nuclear weapons. We have North Korea that is engaged in the use of missiles or missile experiments across the Sea of Japan. You have the Venezuelans that are now working with Iran to create a kind of insidious environment all over South America. And these aren't issues. These are not considered issues. The issue, of course, is a housing development in the West Bank. That's an issue. That's something that they're concerned about. So, again, the crises are very selective in this administration, and what's a crisis may not be a crisis by any objective standard. And so, again, the reason why the word crisis is used in conjunction with health care is to try and put pressure on the legislature to make a decision.
It's almost childlike, isn't it? I have to have it right now. I have to have it right now. At some point, this is going to turn into a credibility problem.
Well, I think it is, and that's one of the reasons why the Tea Parties, I think, have gained some traction. They've gained traction because I think the public understands intuitively that there's something wrong with what's going on. Why this rapidity? Why the need to move this rapidly? It doesn't seem to make an awful lot of sense. And the public, I think, is raising some very appropriate questions here. After all, if you were to look at the kind of public approval ratings that the president has, he's gone down dramatically to something on the order of between 45% and 47%. So now he's even digging into his Democratic base. He won with 53%. So you're starting to see the erosion of support in the United States, and it's quite clear the president does not have as much support on this bill that he had hoped for. So that's one of the reasons to use the word crisis. I mean, if it's a crisis, then you've got to act.
One more thing I wanted to touch on briefly with you, and I know your time is not unlimited, has to do with the corruption of the whole concept of how we define our heroes in this country. The passing of three people, Teddy Kennedy, Walter Cronkite, Michael Jackson, gave us endless media coverage, whether we wanted it or not. You could have done without it.
I could have done without it. I've described them as false prophets. Look, I mean, whatever modest accomplishments they have, they certainly do not belong in the pantheon of American heroes. And when you consider the flaws that each of them represent, it seems to me rather absurd that we go through this orgy of approval that appears on television screens. I think Americans need heroes, and they need heroes who are genuine, and they need heroes who do things like give their lives, sacrifice their lives for the role that Americans play abroad. Our soldiers and sailors and Marines perform an enormous service for this country. They do not get this kind of public approbation. You have people across this country who get up each morning and do something to sustain the economy. You have people in hospices who are giving their time and volunteering to help others. They do not receive this kind of attention. And it seems to me that when you consider the fact that Teddy Kennedy left a young girl die in a car as he swam to safety and tried to protect his reputation, and you think about Cronkite, who was responsible for undermining our war effort in Vietnam, and you think about Michael Jackson, who was drug-addled and possibly a pedophile, why are we giving so much attention to these people when there are real heroes in our midst who we overlook?
It's Herb London, herblondon.com on the web, Hudson.org for the Hudson Institute, and the name of the book again is
America's Secular Challenge.
Good. Thank you, Mr. London. Pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you, sir.
It's Hot Talk 560 KSFO. 735, and Big Buck checks in from the Wall Street Journal with some stock market numbers. What about it, dude?
Well, it's another slow go, Lee. I guess someone forgot about trading today or something. We have the Dow up 3.5. At 96.31, NASDAQ up 2, ditto for the S&P 500. Crude oil up 0.5% at 72.30 a barrel, and the yield on the 10-year note, 3.319%. Interest rates are falling. It would seem our folks are feeling better about the economy and their own situations. Consumer sentiment rose in early September to the strongest in 3 months, with growing expectations the economy will improve. Apparently, investors are not reacting all that much to that bit of data. Real Network subscription music service Rhapsody has been approved for use on iPhones and iPod Touches. It's the first time Apple has allowed an on-demand music streaming program on its devices in the U.S. The initial download will be free, but new subscribers will have to pay $14.99 a month if they want to try it for longer than 7 days. Once again, the blue chips up now 4.5, NASDAQ up to S&P up to
$14.99 a month. I'll hum quietly to myself.
and then you'll save the money also. Mm-hmm. And you can put that back in your 401k.
Yes.
I'm Buck McCoy at the Wall Street Journal on Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
You're listening to Lee Rogers on Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
Oh, there's so much confusion. President Obama apparently can't make up his mind about how many Americans don't have health insurance. For months, he was saying 47 million. Then in his Wednesday night speech to Congress, he said 30 million. And now he says, he's getting more precise, 46.3 million. And, oh, here we go again. Obama's going to give a speech about the financial crisis on Monday, marking the anniversary. I didn't know they made a greeting card for this, the anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers. The White House propaganda mill, the Ministry of Truth, says he will discuss the aggressive steps the administration has taken to bring the economy back from the brink. All together now. My God, will the man never shut up? Does he have nothing to do but go around reading his pet teleprompter? Good Lord.
Guess not.
By the way, here's another example, one of an infinite number of examples of how the media shill for Barack Obama. According to a CNN poll, two out of three Americans who watched President Obama's health care reform speech favor his health care plans. Now, that sounds good, right? Until you stop to consider this. Who did watch his speech? Mostly Democrats, of course. So you get the built-in slant right there. You want numbers? Here they are. In the very last paragraph of CNN's report on its own poll, it says the sample they took, the sample of speech watchers, was 45% Democrat and 18% Republican. Gee, you think that might account for that high rate of approval? I mean, given that enormous imbalance, how would you expect the poll to come out?
Jesus God.
And, you know, they assume that most people are stupid and just take this at face value, and they're probably right. Afghanistan. President Obama calls Afghanistan the good war. I suspect if you're over there getting shot at, it may not seem all that great. But anyway, the dear leader is starting to get heat from his own party over his plans to send more troops over there.
It's a warning shot across the bow for the White House from Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
I don't think there's a great deal of support for sending more troops to Afghanistan in the country or in the Congress.
President Obama has not ruled out sending more troops. Speaker Pelosi says a report to Congress on the situation there later this month will lead to congressional hearings on what to do about the war. Vic Ratner, ABC News at the Capitol.
This is a bizarre story from the wonderful world of sports. Gender tests on South Africa's 800-meter world champion, Caster Semenya. She owns the record, fastest in the world. Gender tests have reportedly revealed new details. We have Linda Alban at the Foreign Desk with an explanation.
It's not official, but it's been reported the tests show South African runner Caster Semenya has some female and male sex organs. Questions about the sexuality of the 18-year-old arose just before her winning the 800-meter title in Berlin. The International Association of Athletics Federation says the results are in, but advised caution until they're examined by experts. But it's looking as if the IAAF will at some point have to weigh the interests of the athlete, an apparent innocent victim in all this, with its responsibility to ensure fair competition.
No, OV, we're not going to do it. We're not.
No.
No references to never spending another lonely Saturday night or anything. No.
No.
Leave it alone. Sometime today, should have been out by now, I would think, but sometime today, the latest report on the level of poverty in America is going to be released by the federal government. And when you hear the numbers, you might want to keep this in mind and ask, what is poverty in America as defined by your own beloved government? Robert Rector of the Heritage Foundation went through the government's own numbers and learned, for example, that the average person identified as poor by your government has a living standard. Well, here are some of the specifics. According to the government's own surveys, the typical poor American has cable or satellite television, two color TVs, and a DVD player or a VCR. He has air conditioning, a car, a microwave, a refrigerator, a stove, and a clothes washer and dryer, and is able to obtain medical care whenever it's needed. His home is in good repair. By his own report, his family is not hungry, and he had sufficient money in the past year to meet his family's essential needs. How many other people in this world would love to have that standard of living? But to liberal politicians, this person living in poverty is a reason to lay a guilt trip on everybody else. It's 13 minutes before 8 o'clock.
You're waking up with Lee Rogers on Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
I think you might be amused by this. Sarah Palin still clearly just scares the daylights out of Democrats, although she has really been low-profiling it lately. But how else would you explain the fact that in their talking points issued to their fellow Democrats and their media suck-ups, the Obamianists mentioned only one name in their attack on Republicans after that health care farce the other night.
Mm-hmm.
The only name they mentioned, of course, was Sarah Palin. Obviously, they're nervous in their knowledge that Sarah Palin has the kind of natural charisma that doesn't come from teleprompter. Governor Palin, you get to keep the title even after you're gone from office. Governor Palin responded to Obama with this posting on her website. In his speech, the president directly responded to concerns I've raised about unelected bureaucrats being given power to make decisions affecting life or death health care matters. He called these concerns bogus, irresponsible, and a lie. So much for civility. After all the name-calling, though, what he did not do is respond to the arguments we've made, arguments even some of his own supporters have agreed have merit. They're scared to death of her. They pee their pants at the very mention of her name. Of course, many of them have never been toilet trained. Anyway, it's 8 minutes before 8 o'clock. OV now with a look at the road ahead.
When now a SIG alert crosses our desk here. It's 880 southbound before Marina Boulevard. It's a motorcycle down, two left lanes blocked. The coroner is responding, hence the SIG alert. 880 southbound before Marina. Another couple of accidents here. One Pleasanton, 580 westbound before El Charro. Multiple vehicles involved in that one. Some notes on this one say maybe up to four cars or vehicles involved. And under the heading Major Problem, here's San Jose, South King in both directions at Saraland Drive closed. This is the broken water main they're trying to repair. Hey, Toyota owners, right now when you buy three tires, you get the fourth for a dollar. Visit the participating genuine Toyota Service Center today. Some restrictions apply. Ends September 30th. It's Officer Vic. It's Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
You're listening to Lee Rogers on Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
Mr. Limbaugh wants to talk to you here in just a couple of minutes. First, we have, well, this is kind of dismaying, irony in the news. Mr. Gunther Link of Vienna, Austria, was first reported to be missing but was found trapped in an elevator at his local parish church. When he was released from the elevator, he said he had been so scared he prayed devoutly to be released. And he was released. Mm-hmm. So, next day, he went back to the church to give thanks for his rescue and was killed when the 860-pound stone altar fell on him.
Oh, God. dear.
That's not funny.
No. No, it's horrible. It's
yes.
Good God.
That may have been his last thought.
Exactly.
Who knows? Who knows?
Oh, dear.
Rush after this.
My friends, the great debate being waged across our country is not over health care reform. It's over our very form of government. In the past, conservatives argued for limited government, while the liberals passed big government programs and policies that have become institutionalized in the fabric of our lives. But now the stakes have been raised. The argument is no longer limited government versus intrusive government. Liberals, epitomized by Obama and congressional Democrats, are advocating unlimited government. That's what we're up against here. The federal government has taken over America's mortgage industry. 90% of all home loans are under government control. Our largest automakers are under government control, as are large swaths of the financial sector. The entire free market energy sector is waiting for the axe to fall via cap and trade regulations, which will effectively nationalize them. Unaccountable, unelected government czars now set policy in an executive branch that is unrestrained by constitutional checks and balances. Intelligence officers who, under a previous administration, served our country at a time of national peril, are now subject to political trials by an out-of-control Justice Department. In his speech to the nation, Obama shamelessly used Ted Kennedy's memory to force unpopular, unworkable health care reforms down America's throats. He said, "What we face is above all a moral issue. It isn't just the details of policy at stake," he said, "but the character of our country." What's at stake, Mr. Obama, is the survival of our country as we know it and love it.
Rush is coming up at 9 on Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
You're listening to Hot Talk 560 KSFO. San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose.
Here's the latest from ABC News.